Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I'm Ken Levine, your podcast host. As always, this is part two, my two-part interview with Preston Beckman, who was a major force in network programming for over 35 years. He was at NBC during the must-see TV era, also spent many years at Fox. He is now a media consultant. If you missed last week's episode after you listen to this one, go back and check that out. This week, we get into pilots. We get into network programming and streaming programming, algorithms, and the possible impact of work stoppages in the industry. Fascinating guest, Preston Beckman. Part two coming up right now on Hollywood and Levine. I noticed that Netflix commissioned a pilot, and this is very new for them because Netflix normally will pick up a show and just send it to series. And they're making a pilot. And I find it interesting that anytime a new form of delivering entertainment comes along, they always try to be different and cutting edge. And over time, it seems they all drift back to the central broadcast model because it works. Talk a little bit about pilots and the value in pilots as opposed to, oh, we're just going to sign this guy up and go make 10 shows.
Right. Well, I will. Left Twitter, I would always...
too?
Yeah. I would always, whenever there'd be stories like this, you know, I would always say all television regresses to the mean. And I always, always believe that. That's what I meant when we started this conversation about technology driving things as opposed to the business of entertainment driving things. You've seen over the years the streamers starting to look more and more like networks. It's been the growth in fast channels. Which are advertiser supported. Netflix now is they're all becoming advertiser supported. Why? Because they can't sustain themselves with this subscription model, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you also, in addition to, and I'll get to the pilots in a second, in addition to making pilots, it used to be Netflix doesn't cancel anything. These streamers never cancel the
show. Yeah, well, now they cancel a ton of shows.
Right. Now, after 1 year, every day you look at the Hollywood Reporter and Variety and you see how many shows don't make it beyond the first year. Gee, that sounds familiar. And by the way, while that's happening, I think you're seeing the broadcast networks being more patient in their shows because they realize, you know, what's the point of constantly trying to churn the schedule. As far as pilots go, I think, you know, I'm a strong believer in pilots and pilot testing. I know we might disagree about that.
No, I believe in pilot testing as a tool, as the deciding factor.
But again, I'm sure we've had this conversation. It's never, I think there's a mis, perception that network executives would sit there and say, we're only going to put our highest testing shows on the air. That's just not what happens. I've seen most shows that get on the air don't test strong. They test kind of in the middle somewhere. What I do know is that, and this is probably why it's valuable for Netflix to test some shows, is if a show tests really bad, I've never seen that show succeed. And I'm talking about
about Seinfeld?
That's why I said, and I'm talking about really bad. Seinfeld was it was medium. Seinfeld was in that.
There's always the impression that Seinfeld was like the worst testing show in history.
No. Most shows, by the way, I'm not saying that it was a strong, definitely wasn't a strong testing pilot. But if you look at the Seinfeld test and you look at the Friends test, they weren't that far apart. So the art of testing a pilot, and, you know, when I was at Fox, I had research reporting to me, and the head of research, a good friend of mine, Melva Benoit, and I would approach pilot testing not as this is strong, this is weak, this is moderate. We would approach it as everything's going to series. Okay? So we're testing this show assuming it goes to series.
Oh, okay.
We're going to tell you what you need to do, or what we believe based on the testing you need to do in order for this show to succeed in series. So we would say, and so sometimes we would have some really good, good testing shows where we would say, you know, there's really not a lot. You know, here's the strengths, stay with the strengths. But then there were some shows where we say, well, look, if you want the show to succeed, here are the four things you need to address. And if you don't address them, fine. That's your choice. But we think by addressing them, you will have a stronger show. So we would never go into the executive room with recommendations for what you should pick up, what you shouldn't pick up. So that's not our job. It's my job a little bit as a scheduler, but it wasn't our job in research. Our job was, here's what we're hearing from the audience, and here's what will make this a successful show. And here are the obstacles that you have to overcome. Okay. Every once in a while, we would get a pilot that was so terrible that we would, we would just say, you know, guys, you know, especially if the executives were very high on it, you know, and we just said, we got to bust this bubble. And by the way, they'd still put it on the air and it would fail. But at least we would say, guys, you know, danger, Will Robinson. Don't know. And I remember, by the way, the opposite is also the case. Every once in a while, you would get a high testing pilot and you would say, you know, I don't think so. I remember there's one at Fox. There was one comedy that we tested, and it was very high testing. And the head of research said, don't put this on because the whole story's been told in the pilot.
In the pilot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you told, the story's been told, so there's no story to follow. You basically did a really nice 30-minute drama here, or comedy, whatever it was, and it's concluded. And they went, screw you. They ordered six, and it never made it. The episode two never got on the air. Episode one never got on the air. Because they looked at it and they said, gee, they were right. There's no, what's going on here? What are we supposed to be talking about? So I think, Netflix is smart in doing that. I'm not sure what show it is, but maybe it's a show that's going to be expensive. And, you go, if it's going to be expensive, we better make sure before we invest in this that there's something here.
Meanwhile, the broadcast networks have done very few pilots this year. And again, is that just cost cutting, or is that them saying, you know what, we'd rather just keep the schedule and let people find these shows, even though their ratings are mediocre, than to bring on six new shows?
Yeah. I think that has a lot. Look, I still look at the ratings every day. And everything is in the on broadcast networks 0.2 to 0.5 stage. You know, I mean, I remember.
It's unbelievable.
I know. Yeah. Everything. I'm talking about 1849, which is still the currency.
The only thing that counts. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're in that 0.2 to 0.5 stage, I believe, you know, you hold on to as much as you can, because you know that the more change you make, you're going to start to get into those 0.1s, 0.0s. So I think that's what I'm saying. In a way, the broadcast networks are becoming what people thought the streamers were going to be, which is very conservative, very consistent. But again, they're limited in the number of hours they can program. You're also seeing, I think, for a while there, the broadcast networks were starting to fall into the trap of making fewer episodes. You know, we'll make 7 episodes or 8 episodes. And now
right.
I think you're starting to see it coming back to, well, there's nothing wrong with making 22 of these puppies. or 24 in the case of comedy sometimes, because people will watch them and it's harder to repeat. You know, repeats do nothing. So I might as well just make what people want to see. So even they're coming, I think they're coming around again to let's make more of what works.
The irony is, you know, for years, creative people would say, we don't want to be on the networks. We want the creative freedom of going to Netflix and Hulu and Apple. And now the networks are saying, okay, you go to Apple and you can make 6 episodes, or you can come here to NBC and make 22.
Right.
All of a sudden, NBC is looking pretty good to you.
Yeah. That's what we've been saying, is that, you know, the what worked 20 years ago still works. I still find it humorous that so many people who work for the streamers start at the broadcast networks, because I think eventually you come around to saying, you know, experience does matter and understanding how broadcasting works matters. I believe that people who schedule broadcast networks have a role on streamers. There's a good friend of mine who's over at Netflix who was a scheduler. So slowly but surely, they're starting to see that there's a lot of the skill sets that broadcasters have are transferable to the streaming services. So, and by the way, the streaming stuff on the streaming services that's successful, that's original to them, looks like network shows now.
Yeah, it does.
my wife and I just finished watching The Night Agent, which is Sean Ryan,
yeah, from The Shield.
And I'm watching this show, and I keep turning to my wife and saying, you know, putting aside the language, this show could be on any broadcast network. A show just started on Netflix called The Diplomat, which we haven't gotten to yet.
It's kind of faux Aaron Sorkin.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So slowly but surely, and you know, multi-camera, you see more of multi-camera shows on the streaming services.
My daughter and her husband partner work on the Upshaws.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, it's you're starting to see again that the streamers are going, well, you know, maybe people want to see stuff that they're comfortable with, and maybe people want to see stuff that feels like stuff they've already seen. And what are we trying to do here? And,
right. You know, why reinvent the wheel?
Exactly. And, you know, or rather than reinventing the wheel, just make it look better, make it look attractive, but don't change. Don't make it a square.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more of what we watch, and we do watch a lot of stuff on streaming services, looks to me like broadcast shows. So it's all, again, coming together, hopefully we're almost through with the sexy stage until the next way of delivering shows come along. and then we'll be back to streamers. Yeah, you know, that's yesterday.
Well, one thing, you know, you mentioned how you're able to measure success on a broadcast network by ratings, which result in higher rates for commercials, et cetera. So you could be a showrunner and your show airs on Tuesday night and you can read the ratings on Wednesday and you have a good idea as to whether or not you can buy a house or get a new line of profession. But with Netflix and the streamers, there are all these algorithms that the shows have to hit. And for the most part, the creative staff doesn't know what those algorithms are. So they're just shooting at moving targets. Do you have some idea of what the kind of algorithms might be that Netflix is using to judge shows?
I can guess a little bit. As I said, I have friends, but I don't ask them these kind of questions. I don't want them to feel I'm prying. I think it really comes down to the number of how long you stay with something, how many episodes you're willing to watch, and how quickly you watch them would be some of the metrics that they use. I mean, a lot of people, because there's so much, will graze and will watch a show. I think a lot of there's a chunk of people who say they reject it quickly and they don't come back. So I think it's about how many minutes of a show, how long, and how quickly you watch it. Because I think they know that if you don't watch a show quickly, that you're probably not engaged in it. The big thing now is,
when you say quickly, do you mean from when it premieres or
binging? Yeah. In other words, how bingeable is the show?
Oh, I see. So in other words, do you watch an episode and then you watch another episode a week later, or you watch an episode and you say, oh, this is really good, and you start watching two a night and three a night the next night? I see.
Yeah. I think that what happens is there's so much, and I'm sure it's true of you. You know, sometimes you'll watch something, you go, that's pretty good, but you have seven or eight other shows you're watching,
mm-hmm.
and you know, you like about 2 months later, you go, oh yeah, you know, if I was really interested in it, I would have probably checked it out. So I think that. What I find interesting is, again, one of the things that the streamers are doing, which was part of broadcast culture forever, is you're seeing more and more shows dropping weekly as opposed to all at once, which originally was why, you know, you wanted Netflix or why you wanted these. I think Netflix is still pretty much I drop it all at once platform. But I mean, I find now that I'm watching certain shows like Mrs. Maisel and Ted Lasso and a couple other shows. I have to remember that they were on every week. And sometimes I forget they're on, or sometimes I forget what day they drop. But I'm finding that's also a way to keep these shows in the zeitgeist longer, as opposed to I'll drop something and within a week I'm onto something else. But I think that they're looking for engagement as much as anything. And that's what I think it is your commitment to a show. And if it's bingeable, then they'll maybe order another season.
See, I'm one of those people that basically takes advantage of both, in that I won't start a show until there's three or four episodes in and I've heard good things about it, or there's something interesting about the show that motivates me to watch it. And if I like it, then I'll watch the three or four episodes over two nights and then I'm hooked. So then it's like, all right, I know every Friday is going to be another episode of the Jennifer Garner Show. So, right. So I'll watch that. Yeah.
I find that I have a list of shows that I think my wife and I will enjoy, and it gets longer and longer and longer. So at some point, so I'll always start with the most recent, you know, because I figure, okay, if I haven't gotten to something, maybe I'll get to it down the road. And then at that point, it becomes word of mouth and things like that. So in other words, like we have not started The Diplomat yet. I'm hoping we will. But by the time we get to that, maybe What We Do in the Shadows is back. Maybe Reservation Dogs is back. You know, all of a sudden there are these other shows that you go, well, I have to watch them. And The Diplomat just like fades into the sunset. You know,
right.
And, you know, then maybe if there's a second season, I go, well, and there probably will be. I go, okay, well, maybe I'll try and jump on board, you know.
What's interesting is what's considered a hit. I mean, Ted Lasso, if you live in Los Angeles or live in New York, Ted Lasso is a huge hit. But when you do the math, it's on Apple, which is arguably not the most major of streamers. So you figure, well, what percentage of the country can even access Ted Lasso? And of those people who do subscribe to Apple TV, how many watch Ted Lasso? And, you know, I think when you crunch the numbers, you go, well, wait a minute. This is like maybe a drop in the bucket in terms of an audience.
I think, yeah. Well, two things. One is we're dealing with TV critics, you know, and TV critics are the most out of touch people on the planet with the public. I was even talking, you know, I'll give you an example in politics. You know, when you think about how many people watch Tucker Carlson every night, less than 1% of the country watches Tucker Carlson, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much attention or space was Tucker Carlson given when Rupert fired him? About 50% of all media was about the firing of Tucker Carlson.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Why? Because they're talking about themselves. Okay. You know, the New York Times, whatever, they're talking about themselves.
Right. The media.
Yeah. The same thing with TV critics. TV critics talk to each other. They create a world that they like, not that you, that the average person likes. So it's a very, so that's part of it, is that it's a manufactured hit. It's a perception among a small group of people. The second thing is for Apple, it's a prestige show. So it's kind of like what House of Cards was, or Orange is the New Black was for Netflix, or Mad Men was for AMC mm-hmm. back in the day. It wasn't mm-hmm. that people watched it. It was that it was getting the attention as some kind of quality show, and therefore Apple makes quality shows. I mean, that's what...
It was Cheers the first year, if we're being honest.
Right.
Because we never had the ratings.
Yeah, well, remember we used to call it NBC? We would call it the quality shows on NBC. You know, why? Because, you know, it was the Grant Tinker first be best, then be first kind of philosophy of programming. So I think that a show like Ted Lasso says to the world out there, well, maybe I should subscribe to Apple TV. Maybe there are other shows, you know, on Apple TV. So it's really not about the numbers. It's about the perception, which is fueled by people who write about shows.
Right. Meanwhile, they're getting big ratings over at Netflix or whatever with Squid Games, right? And Sharknado is getting big numbers. So before we go,
yes.
Again, crystal ball time. We are recording this the end of April. And as we sit here, the contract between the Writers Guild and the producers is up May 1st. Should there be a strike, how much effect do you think it will have on things? Because it seems to me now that, like you say, Netflix has so much product and all these, you know, mega corporations that even if they take a loss, you know, Discovery Warner just said, okay, screw it, Batgirl, we'll just, you know, eat a $100 million thing. How much effect do you think it will have?
Oh, I hate to, you know, I'm sorry, Ken, I want to say something and, you know, I think it will have an effect. I think it'll have.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
On the broadcast networks. I mean, the pilots have been shot. But so I kind of remember when I was at Fox and there was a writer's strike. It was somewhere in like September. It was somewhere when once the season had begun. So it was a real, it hurt. I mean, it hurt and it didn't. It actually was, I shouldn't say it was extremely profitable for Fox. And also we had American Idol at the time. So we could just expand the number of hours. And I think short term, I hope they settle it quickly.
I do too.
And I hope that the mistake that I felt the writers made back when I was at Fox was not to realize how important the internet streaming, how all those things were going to, what they were going to evolve into. I mean, when that strike was settled, I kind of scratched my head a little bit and said, I think they've left a lot on the table. I think they've kind mm-hmm. of ignored the future and don't see how, where we are now, you know, how they're kind of not accounting for a lot of the ways their work is going to be used. So I hope that it's quick and I hope that there's a correction of, you know, of here's how we use what you make create for us. And I think long term, I mean, if the strike goes on beyond, you know, if you get into August, September, if it starts soon and, you know, the summer goes by, that's then there's a problem.
Well, I also think with the director's contract and the actor's contract coming up the end of June, I think if you have all three unions going out, then that just puts a halt to everything.
Right. And it can't just all be reality TV. It can't all be international shows. So, look, I hope for everybody's sake that wise heads prevail, and it's important. And the writers get what they deserve, or at least are understand the ways in which, which I don't think they did the last time. Their products being used and. That's how I feel about it. I don't want to say anything. And
that's okay. That's okay. But again, you know, it's an issue that may come up and may cause upheaval. You and I have both been through many Writers Guild strikes mm-hmm. and work stoppages
in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I was picketing you. Yeah.
I was trying to figure out how to fill 15 hours of a schedule. And my head of Fox at the time was no help. I used to say to him, Peter, can you give me some idea about when this is going to be resolved so I can figure it? No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was scary there.
Well, that's another difference. You know, back in the old days, you know, we'd go on strike, and when Lou Wasserman of Universal would go, okay, that's enough, then the strike would be settled in 2 days.
Yeah, right.
I don't
know
if we have a Lou Wasserman now. Probably. We need it. We need a Lou Wasserman. Preston, come out of retirement.
I've given my pint of blood. I'm through.
You don't want to run show business?
No, that's not me. That's not. I've never been. I couldn't wait. You know, there's only three ways you leave. They they either throw you out, they carry you out, or you walk out with some shred of dignity. And I chose the third way and never looked back.
Never. Yeah, me too. Preston, this has, as always, been such a joy, so informative. You are one of my favorite guests.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you so much for coming on again.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, you are up to date now on the current state of television. Probably by next Thursday, it'll all change again, but at least at the moment, you are up to date. Our thanks to Preston Beckman, also to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, Bruce and Jason Miller. And I want to plug a couple of plays I have going this month. If you are in Elmhurst, Illinois, the Green Man Troupe is doing my play, Love and Tear Gas. Tickets are available. And if you are in beautiful Inglewood, New Jersey, you can see my play, Guilty Pleasures, at the Black Box Theater. Tickets are available there, too. And if you want to email me, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com, that's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com, you can also get in touch with me by checking out and following my Instagram account, Hollywood and Levine, where you can see some of my cartoons. Thanks again to you guys for listening, and we will see you again next week. Bye. Hollywood and Levine.